Hello, and welcome to the Retirement Repair Shop podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Transamerica. Thank you for your support. I'm your host, Mary Beth Franklin. This is the third season, and we will focus on women investors and the unique challenges they face. Over the next decade, women are expected to gain control of as much as $30 trillion in financial assets as they outlive or separate from their spouses and partners. That is in addition to the personal assets that many women have accumulated over their long careers. But while the future is decidedly female, financial advisors could do more to accommodate them. Women-controlled wealth may present vast opportunities, but managing it requires a nuanced approach. During this podcast, we will discuss some of the challenges that women investors face during their life journeys, such as caregiving, late-in-life divorce, and widowhood, and we'll offer ideas on how financial advisors can better communicate with and serve female clients. In this first episode, we will delve into the emotional challenges and financial impact of caregiving. That's an event that is nearly twice as likely to happen to women than men. I am delighted to introduce today's guest expert, Liz O'Donnell. Liz is the founder of Working Daughter, a community for women balancing elder care, career, and more. Her latest book, Working Daughter, A Guide to Caring for Your Aging Parents While Earning a Living, was named one of the best books of 2019 by Library Journal. Liz, thank you for joining me today on the Retirement Repair Shop. I know your passion for caregivers and caregiving has very personal roots. Please tell us your story.
Thank you, Mary Beth. My story started on July 1st, 2014, a day I'll never forget, when both of my parents were diagnosed with terminal illnesses at two different hospitals. I was told my dad had Alzheimer's and my mother stage 4 ovarian cancer. And at the time, I was working in a really high-pressure job. I was doing business development for a marketing firm. I had two kids in elementary school. My first book had just come out, and I was the breadwinner for our family. So my life was pretty full, and then elder care sort of, you know, fell into my lap when I got the crisis call. And I think the biggest challenge for me at that time, Mary Beth, was, and then even for the next few years as my father's dementia advanced, was staying employed. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done, juggling elder care and my job, because elder care doesn't follow any schedule. It's full of surprises and it's emotional on top of that. But I had to keep showing up for work because I needed to earn, and so I did.
Wow, I cannot imagine what it was like to be dealing with caregiving issues for both parents. That is heart-wrenching, and knowing the juggles of being a working mother, a working parent, a worker, along with these caregiver roles. As you pointed out, not only does caregiving involve this incredible juggling act for working women, but it can also exact an enormous financial toll in terms of possibly lost salaries and consequently foregone savings. Did you ever tally what your caregiving role cost you financially?
Ugh. Yeah, I did. I wish I hadn't, but I guess knowledge is power, right? I figured I was hands-on caregiver for about 7 years. So I think it was about $10,000 a year. So $70,000. And that's just salary. We're not talking about, you know, what didn't therefore then go into 401k, et cetera, et cetera. So not lost benefits, just salary. And I got to that number by looking at the fact that first thing I did was change positions in my firm. I took a job that didn't require so much networking because it was impossible to do. For the first time ever in my career, I started to receive, let's call them lukewarm performance reviews and salary adjustments commensurate to those bad reviews. I took unpaid leave after using up vacation and sick time. And I think it's important to point out, I'm one of the lucky ones who has paid time off. You know, there are so many family caregivers who don't even have paid time off to dip into before the unpaid. So that's how I got to that number. And it's significant.
Well, and as you say, you're one of the lucky ones, the thousands or millions of people out there who don't have those resources. But you took the time to add up what this was costing you financially. Right there, that should demonstrate the importance of why caregivers should work with a financial professional to keep them on track. But, you know, like any kind of relationship, not all relationships are a good fit. And sometimes you need to walk away. Tell us about your experience with one particular financial advisor.
Sure. I actually didn't sit down with a financial advisor for a few more years. Sadly, my caregiving journey continued because a few months after my father passed away, my husband was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. So I became a spousal caregiver. And when he passed away, that's when I sat down with a financial advisor who came highly recommended. And I went in and I told this person, I'd like to review my assets and I'd like you to model some different scenarios for me. I was looking at two kids approaching college pretty soon. You know, I wanted them to say, if you do this, then that happens. If you pull this lever, then that happens. You know, those kinds of different scenarios so that I could make some decisions and understand my financial picture. But that isn't what happened at all. Instead, I felt shamed. Why aren't you here, not there? Well, you know, we just explained. I just was going through 7 years of caregiving. I wasn't investing in career and retirement funds at the time. So the shame really wasn't helpful. It reflected a lack of knowledge of what, you know, the toll that caregiving does take on a career, et cetera, et cetera. And the other thing was I felt like the financial advisor placed their values on my scenario instead of mine. So quick example is I inherited my parents' summer home when they passed away. It's a place that I spent every summer of my life and my kids spent every summer. And cousins live next door. We've got a big extended family. And this financial advisor said, so of course you need to sell that if you want to send your kids to college.
And I can imagine here you've lost your family connections, both your parents and your husband had passed away at that point as well, I guess. And the one thing that's holding your family together, this emotional family homestead, and yet someone is insensitive enough to basically reduce that to merely an outgoing expense.
That's exactly it, Mary Beth. That's exactly the feeling that I had. This is my children's connection to the family that they need around them right now, to memories, et cetera, et cetera. And so this financial advisor just looked at numbers, not the people behind those numbers. You know, and maybe I needed to hear some tough messages and make some tough decisions, but I wanted options. And I wanted to know that the person across the table from me saw me, understood my life, and then we could move forward. Exactly.
And I'm just curious, how did you find this person to start with? Was this a referral from a friend? Was this plugging in your zip code into a website to find a financial advisor?
Referral from a friend, somebody in my networking circle. So it was just a shocking experience.
And how do you recover from something like that? Some people would just shut down and say, that's it. I never need another financial advisor. That was an awful experience. What was your initial reaction?
Exactly what you just said. You know, but I also decided to take some space. I had just been through a pretty traumatic experience. I thought to myself, I'm going to let it ride for a little while, trust in, you know, what my husband and I have been doing, and then go back when things are less emotional.
And I'm sure that you were plodding along step by step and probably thought, well, I've done it this far on my own. I guess I could keep going. When did that little Jiminy Cricket voice in the back of your head say, maybe you want a second opinion? When did that happen?
It was probably about 9 months later. Yeah. But yeah, I took time just to say, you know what? Everything was set up. I don't have to do everything at once. I don't have to panic. And quite frankly, I just didn't want to walk into that scenario again. So it was about 9 months before I thought, okay, you're feeling a little better. Gotten other parts of your life under control. You can do this.
Right. And so then what was the next step? Did you go for another referral or were you much more cautious in seeking references before you made a plunge again?
No, I did seek another referral from a family member and it went from there.
And tell me about the second experience. How did that work out? A new financial advisor.
Much better experience. You know, again, I went in and I explained my last scenario and I said, I want options. you know, help me look at different models. I'm not looking for you to tell me what kind of college to send my kid to, which was another thing that came up in that conversation. I'm looking for, if you do this, you know, then you can't do that. If you want this, then you should make these shifts. And then I will make the decisions from there.
And how did that go? Did you get that sort of advice? And were you able to make decisions on your own based on that advice?
Yeah. And I wouldn't say the decisions were made on my own. I mean, they were made with counsel, but, and I think everybody goes into a financial planning situation wanting different things. So, you know, it's important that that financial advisor understands that.
And just curious, and this really shouldn't have much bearing, but were you dealing with a man initially and then a woman? Were they both men? What were the genders of the advisors?
Actually, the first scenario was a woman and the second was a man. So I would have expected differently, which maybe is a terrible thing to say, only from the standpoint of the woman was similar in age, you know, and I think what's important is for financial advisors is to see the life around their client, right?
That's a very good point that, I mean, you talked about this initial traumatic experience. And frankly, I'm just as prejudiced. I falsely assumed, well, I guess she was talking to some guy who was crunching numbers. Shame on me for making that assumption. So having gone through two very different experiences, in general, are there guidelines you can give financial advisors when they're dealing with someone in a caregiver role? And I guess here, we shouldn't assume that those caregivers are women as well. You're dealing with a client who's in a very vulnerable position that is juggling caregiver responsibilities that, as you pointed out, don't work on a schedule and may be affecting your job as well. I might have to scale back my professional role. I may not be getting those great performance review. What should financial advisors be taking in when they're meeting a caregiving client for the first time?
Yeah, you bring up a good point. My work focuses mainly on women, but 40% of family caregivers are men, in fact. So when a financial advisor is dealing with an adult child, I think it's really important that they look at the whole family, at the extended picture, because as that working daughter or, you know, adult caregiver, you are balancing your own financial picture and you're looking at your parents' financial picture. And oftentimes they commingle. In fact, the average annual out-of-pocket cost for family caregivers is just under $7,000, according to the AARP. So what is your track for retirement planning and for your personal goals? What other factors are coming at this client in their life, you know, like caring for their aging parents, that may or may not knock them off, you know, knock you off your goals and track? And what is happening with your parents, and have you gotten clarity around their goals and how you may or may not need to help them? So really understanding all of those factors that are coming down on your client. And then there's, you know, the real tactical and simple things, like if you're taking over as power of attorney for your parents, you know, have you thought through passwords and access to online accounts and understanding their financial picture? So I think financial advisors have a real opportunity to take a much more holistic look at families. On the reverse side, my mother arranged for me to meet her financial advisor one day. She really liked this nice man who would come and help her with her money, as she described him. And so she arranged for him to be there the same day I was helping her with groceries or something. And that quick interaction I had with him in her kitchen helped me enormously later when I was trying to figure out what my parents could afford when I found out they were both sick and needed to move into senior living, because I was able to call him and we had a relationship and have him help me put together their financial picture, because I didn't know it at the time.
Well, that sounds like it was certainly a very fortunate encounter, and that your mother must have been a very intuitive woman to say, let me put these two important people in my lives together so they can talk to each other.
Well, in hindsight, I realized my mother really gifted me with her own planning. You know, she had planned out her end of life. She had written down her wishes. She had made some really good financial decisions. She introduced me to this man. I didn't realize she was doing all of this at the time. She was pretty much a housewife, and I didn't even know she had the thought processes. But what a gift. And that's another thing that financial advisors can help their clients, is then gift that forward to our children so that we're in good shape and maybe caregiving doesn't become as much of a burden for our children.
You know, you've made an interesting point when you said your mom was a housewife. And I talked to a lot of women who seem to be overwhelmed with the idea of investing and long-term savings for retirement, et cetera. And I usually respond, you run your household. You have a budget. Retirement planning is just budgeting for tomorrow. You've got this.
Excellent point.
And you've made the point about short-term financial needs and long-term financial needs. When you're first thrust into this caregiving role, you've got immediate concerns. Things like you pointed out, passwords, that's so important in today's digitally connected world. What other sorts of immediate things can financial advisors help their caregiving clients with? For example, there's three adult siblings here. Maybe you can divvy up the work. How do you get that going, sort of being a quarterback for the family team of who does what?
Yeah, I know we're asking a lot of these financial advisors, but the more they can build out these softer skills, if you will, these interpersonal skills, I think the better, because caregiving is so emotional. You have your siblings. I always tell people, be prepared to dust off the dysfunction from your childhood. There's nothing like caring for an aging parent that turns you into your seven-year-old self, you know, when you're fighting with your nine-year-old sister all of a sudden again, even though you might be 52 and 54 at the time. So especially after the year that we've been through where people, you know, have gone home to work and we're connecting over Zoom, it's so much easier now to broker these conversations with siblings who may be dispersed. And so if a financial advisor can start to do that and bring families together, set up a Zoom call, start to talk through the picture, oftentimes that's exactly what we family members need. We need an outside consultant who takes away the emotion and the dysfunction and lays out the picture, and you can start to have those conversations. Same thing with spouses. When I started caring for my parents, I had to really carefully navigate my marriage because I was paying out of pocket. I was running out the door every time there was an emergency. I wasn't home for dinner every night. And you have to bring the partners along as well to decide on how much are we going to support mom and dad? How much are we going to support your mom and dad? Can you pick up these challenges for me so that I can focus on caregiving, that sort of thing? Also building a network of support systems. So as a financial advisor, do you have an elder law attorney that you can recommend? Do you have career coaches that you can recommend for these mid-life women who are at critical earning years? And if they step out of the workforce for caregiving, can they step back in? How can you help them through that process?
Liz, you have just raised so many important points, and I want to take them one at a time. One, you talked about the maybe one of the silver linings of the COVID pandemic is our new reliance on Zoom-like technology, virtual meetings, as a way of getting family members literally together on the same virtual page and perhaps diffusing some of the emotion that goes with it. So let's start there. I think the financial planning profession in general was a little late to embrace technology. And as a result of the pandemic, they've been forced to do so. And many of them have been pleasantly surprised. For example, there's one prominent financial advisor that I was talking to, and she said her affluent clients were always too busy to come to a meeting at the same time when one was working late and the other was driving the kids to soccer. And during the pandemic, they're all locked down in the same house, and boom, not only could they get both spouses on the Zoom call at the same time, but they might be able to have intergenerational conversations with their kids going off to college or their elderly parents concerned about caregiving. Any tips for financial advisors of how to use this technology to bring together caregiving adult children and their siblings? What do they need to know that maybe works well in this situation or that may be explosive?
Well, I think you touched on it, and scheduling is one really simple, but can often be, you know, one simple thing that you can look at, but often can be fraught with emotion. You know, I had a 9-to-5 technically a 9-to-5 job. My sister job is weekend. Both of my sisters work weekends. I was the breadwinner for my family, you know, and was all caught up in my career. So are we going to ask me to take time off from work to meet with, somebody as a family Monday through Friday, 9-to-5? Or are we going to ask them to take a time off from work on the weekend? So, but there are times that may not be traditional times that financial advisors meet with clients. But now, because of Zoom, it's possible that we can all find a time, you know, that doesn't mean, you know, Liz is saying that her career is more important than me. You know, I mean, it sounds silly, but you're dealing with such an emotional issue. We're going to get together and talk about mom and dad and their end of life and their later in life planning. And we all have different relationships with our parents, and we all have different views probably of, you know, just how bad it is or how good it is. And so any little thing you can do to sort of level the playing field via Zoom, via scheduling, is going to help.
I have to share a caregiving story with you that happened with my father, who died 25 years ago at this point. And I was a young mother of two children living in the Washington, D.C. area. And my whole family was back in Philadelphia, a manageable journey, a 2.5-hour car ride, but not around the corner. And it seemed that as one of five adult children, we did naturally divvy up roles. My one sister, who was geographically close to my dad, handled a lot of the hands-on errands and caregivings. And I can remember her frustration because he had so little control over his life at that point. He would dictate how and what she should do things. Make sure you take my money from this ATM. I don't want to pay the $3 service charge. Make sure when you go to the grocery store, buy this brand of pretzels. It's the one I like. And me, I was the information person. And I was doing things long distance. And at that point, he was on dialysis. And he lived in the suburbs and was getting dialysis at a suburban hospital. And I went on this saga of trying to find transportation for him. And I found that you could get medical transportation from the city to the suburbs or from the suburbs to the city, but you cannot find it within the suburbs. And then one day when I was driving him to dialysis, I noticed there was a bus outside. And I asked the bus driver, "What is this bus for?" And he said, "Well, we take people to and from dialysis. How do you get on this bus?" And he scribbled a phone number and handed it to me like a secret handshake, saying, "Don't tell people about it. We don't have enough slots." So just because I was there and happened to see a bus and happened to talk to a bus driver, I found out there was a way to get my father public transportation to dialysis. And unfortunately, he died 2 weeks later and never got a chance to use it. But these are the mazes that caregivers have to negotiate. At the same time, they're dealing with the emotions of their siblings and their spouses and their children and placating their employers. So it is a minefield.
It really is a minefield. And there are so many secret handshakes and information. And where do you begin? And that's the other thing, I think, in the age of technology. One of my sisters was out of state. So the two of us who were local would often go and, you know, meet with the hospice nurse to see if we were going to, you know, hire that agency. Check out the assisted living facility to see if that's where we wanted to go, meet with the elder law attorney. And, you know, it's easy as the one who's local, the one who, you know, is going to the ATMs and picking out the brands of pretzels, to think that the sibling who's out of state has it easy. You know, they're not doing the day to day. But I learned in finally listening to my sister, the out of state sibling often feels helpless and not in the know. And this is their parent as well. I mean, not every sibling wants to help. So a scenario where a sibling does want to be involved, technology allows you now to sort of bring them in and then figure out, okay, who can do what?
Right. That's a very good point. And you mentioned other professionals in this scenario, the elder care attorney dealing with housing specialists as you're going to look at various facilities. How did your financial advisor, did he or she introduce you to these professionals, or was willing to work with this team of professionals you already had in place?
I didn't consult a financial advisor till my parents passed. So
going forward, could you give some guidance to financial advisors of how they put a team in place, or at least have a referral network in place that could help caregivers who might need to meet with other professionals that they haven't met yet?
Absolutely. I think if a financial advisor can vet some, you know, local contacts so that when you do need an elder law attorney, you can go from one trusted advisor to another. I think an elder law attorney is a really important part of the picture, and they can really help you avoid costly mistakes. So I think financial advisors and elder law attorneys are a natural partnership and referral system. Same thing with, you mentioned senior living experts. There are some really good ones and valuable ones, and there are some that, quite frankly, aren't that valuable. Some who maybe don't charge you, but then are getting a kickback from the places that they're recommending. So it's important to know that. Some that charge you for something you can find in a simple Google search, quite frankly. So if your financial advisors are doing that legwork so that they have vetted and can recommend senior living advisors as well, then I think that's hugely valuable.
Let's pursue that a little bit, because frankly, you as the caregiving expert probably know a whole lot more about this than the average financial advisor. How would you tell someone who is in a caregiving role and they're looking for these resources on their own? How do you distinguish between someone who may be charging you a fee, like a geriatric care manager, versus a referral service that may be getting a kickback from a certain assisted living facility? And, you know, maybe they're appropriate in various circumstances, but what questions do I need to ask as a caregiver to find the appropriate services for me and my parent that I'm caring for?
Well, I think simply asking, you know, how are you paid? How do you make money? And there's not necessarily anything wrong with getting referral fees from the facilities that you might place someone in or recommend. But if it's just one or two, then, you know, they're not going to be recommending the full breadth of what your parents might need. So asking them how they make money, and then asking them, you know, how often they're on site. One of the most powerful things I found in finding facilities for my parents, and I moved them both several times, so I dealt with a lot of facilities, which is challenging right now during COVID, but eventually will change, was just the on-site review I did. I would pull up and I would sit in the parking lot for a little bit, and I would watch employees. I would try to go during a shift change, and I would watch how employees came to work. And if they were dragging their feet, you know, head down, shoulders slumped, I wasn't as impressed as if they were, you know, looking like they actually were happy to go to work. And the same thing as I walked around the facilities, seeing how employees, everyone from the dietitians to the custodians, did they make eye contact or did they look miserable? And I found that was a really important factor. Well, we can't all take the time to do that. So asking senior living advisors how they evaluate facilities, I think, is really important.
I think that is so insightful. And really, what's more important than seeing the emotional state of the people caring for your loved ones? My one brother was actually in a nursing home for several months before he died. He was an early Alzheimer's victim, but he had been an athlete all his life. And he was one of those people that his body would go on for years long after his mind was gone. And unfortunately, he was crossing the street and was hit by a car in a traumatic accident. And some of us breathed a sigh of relief of, oh, thank goodness he won't have to go to a nursing home after all. Well, it turns out because that body was so strong, he did survive and did end up going to a nursing home. And I'll tell you, I walked in with fear that first day. Oh, my siblings in a nursing home. What is this going to be like? And I watched these nursing home aides as they switch shifts, kissing him on his forehead. Goodbye, bugs. See you tomorrow. And I thought, he is in a loving place. It totally changed my view of what a nursing home could be. But you mentioned a very important point, I think, that not only did you search for a facility for each of your parents who were in very different situations, your dad with dementia, your mom with ovarian cancer, and that you moved them several times. Could you take us through the process? How did you select the first place and why did you decide to change?
Sure. And I just need a moment. Usually I'm the one whose story makes people cry. That's such a beautiful story, Mary Beth, about your brother.
And it came right to the top of my mind because yesterday, my best friend found herself in a situation where her husband's sister, one of those awful situations, early dementia, living on her own, went outside to get the newspaper and fell, broke her hip, you know, was found hours later by a neighbor and is now in the hospital. And they were looking for a nursing home. And I said, let me tell you about a wonderful place.
Wow. Yeah. People have a real fear of nursing homes, understandably, but there are some wonderful nursing homes out there. And for me, it wasn't the beautiful nursing home. It was, you know, in the wonderful neighborhood with all of the pretty lobby. The nursing home I ultimately placed my father in was, you know, nothing special to look at, no great rec room or dining hall or anything like that. It was the staff that made the difference. And so that's how, to answer your question, that's how I evaluated. The first move from my dad was to memory care. And so I found that the driving around looking at places test was most valuable. I know that we don't all have the luxury of flexibility and time off from work, but for me, I found that to be more effective than hiring a senior living consultant, which I also did. I was in such a panic, you know, because I had these two diagnoses on the same day. I threw a lot of money at a lot of things, just like, oh, I'll hire a geriatric care manager and I'll hire a senior living expert. And, you know, I was just casting a wide net. And I found that in my case, the senior living advisor I hired came back with the same exact list that I had found on Google, basically. And so that wasn't the best money spent. I've since met some who really do their work and really understand the facilities they work with. And they're, you know, so there are some out there with tremendous value. It came down to me, two things I remember when I placed my dad in memory care. And then actually I placed my mom in the assisted living attached to that memory care. It came down to two facilities. One was absolutely beautiful, state of the art, you know, really robust memory care facility with all kinds of activities, et cetera, et cetera. The lobby was super modern, fancy, big chandeliers, water fountains, you know, real jazzy, I guess. It was two exits down the highway. The place I ended up placing both of my parents, when you walked into the lobby, it looked like my mother's living room. It was colonial. The sofa could have been the sofa that, you know, was in our living room for years growing up. The colors matched. It was not as fancy. It was not as advanced. It didn't have as many amenities, but it felt more like their home. And I thought that would be important. And it was one exit. And for me, I realized even one more exit down the highway was going to be a factor in my being able to be a hands-on caregiver. And so in choosing where I placed my parents, it came down to what is good for them and what is good for me. I want to make the point here, too, that people often think that they're no longer caregivers when their parents are in a facility. You are still caregiving. You are still part of the team. You're still advocating. And so it has to work for you and them.
It's amazing how many overlaps we have in our personal stories. I'm laughing about the colonial furniture. I one time counted 23 eagles in my mother's living room, you know, that were...
I mentioned eagles, but I didn't know if anyone knew what I was talking about. There were
eagles. It was a classic, I believe, Ethan Allen furniture design. They were embossed on the handles of brassware on the furniture and on the lamps and things like that. And my mother also died of ovarian cancer.
Oh, wow.
She was 62 years old and I was 25. And people often ask me why I specialize in Social Security claiming strategies and rules. And there's several reasons, but one of them goes back to the fact that my mother applied for her Social Security benefit as early as possible at 62. And she did not live out that month, and we had to send her one and only check back. So I do feel a certain obligation to American people that I want you to find the best way to claim benefits because I always felt like my mother did not get her share.
Wow, that's powerful.
Also, you talked about when your parents are in a facility, you're still a caregiver. And I'm sure it was gut-wrenching to have your parents separate into the same facility, different rooms, one memory care, one assisted living. How do you recommend that caregivers deal with that issue of they're still my parents, but they have different needs? And how do we pay for this when they're in two different areas of either a single facility or two different facilities?
Yeah, well, this is why it's so important that we understand their financial picture. At the time, because when I got the diagnoses, also with diagnoses comes discharge from the hospital. And that's another story. But discharge, I think, is the most broken part of our healthcare system. You get very little warning. So I was told, you know, move your dad in a week. If you don't find a place, we will. And it was July 1st. So you had a 3-day holiday in there too. So there wasn't a lot of time to make this decision. And so I did, you know, leave some money on the table in different places. I moved my dad and then my mom got discharged. She lived still an hour away. I had already put her in a respite care for 30 days when my dad first was hospitalized. So I sent her back. I mean, you can only do so much at once, but then you could see that her illness was really progressing. I couldn't have her an hour away. So I broke that contract and I moved her closer to me. So I was signing a lot of leases. I was spending a lot of money and I had this enormous stress because I still hadn't, you know, reconnected with that financial advisor. I was still meeting with elder law attorneys to understand, you know, what all of my options were. So I was making decisions without the big financial picture. So that was really stressful. So I think, you know, the more we can do upfront, the more we can understand what levers we have in our own financial plan with our financial advisors and understand what our parents' financial picture is, you know, asking to be pulled into the fold with our parents if we can to understand their financial picture, then the better off we're going to be. So that then we can understand if dad and mom have different care needs, how am I going to negotiate this? Same thing with starting to understand senior living. I mean, not something most of us want to think about. However, if we understand that there are facilities that are, you know, continuums of care, you can move in independent living and then shift to assisted living and then, you know, shift to memory care if necessary. The difference between assisted living and a nursing home, a lot of people place their parents in assisted living and then wonder why they're not getting nursing care because that doesn't come with assisted living. So the more we can get educated on what the different options are, then we're in a better position if indeed, we're in a better position regardless, but especially if our parents have different needs.
And speaking of options, certainly having money to pay for care gives you a lot more options, or having your parents have their money to pay for care. There's an issue that people have to deal with sometimes where mom or dad may have enough money to get into a facility, but may be there for such a long period of time that they run out of money. And in some cases, a nursing home may keep them there as their personal funds run out, and then they go into a Medicaid situation, which is a joint program between the federal government and the states that subsidize the poor and elderly and is the largest payer of most nursing home bills. That is usually not the case in assisted living, which tends to be private facilities. And if your parents run out of money, they may also run out of time to stay in that facility. What guidelines would you offer caregivers when they're looking at the pot of money that's available and the type of facilities that are out there?
Well, that's where I think a financial advisor who has taken the time to really educate themselves on, you know, later life strategies can be really valuable because you have to take some bets. And I was in that situation. So my mom had stage 4 ovarian cancer. We were only looking at 3 months, you know, exactly what the doctors told us was what happened. So from a financial standpoint, we knew what we were dealing with for the most part. My dad with Alzheimer's, although he was late 80s, the standard around that or the rule of thumb is usually someone can live on average about 10 years from diagnosis. But he was 88 and he had a heart condition. So So you're taking a gamble, if you will, about how long this person is going to live. And memory care is about $10,000 a month more than assisted living care, right? So the money's going to go faster. So a financial advisor who kind of understands that type of planning and can model those different scenarios, you know, if he lives 10 years, if he lives 5 years, what are we looking at? Who can then put you in touch again with that elder law attorney who understands the ins and outs of Medicare and Medicaid? That can be of tremendous value as well, because it really comes down to scenario planning and the what ifs. If dad lives 10 years, then X. If dad lives 5 years, then Y. If dad's, symptoms advance quickly, then X. And I was actually about 6 months out from when my dad died or moved into a nursing home, I forget which, I was looking at just that. He was running out of money. And I was under tremendous stress trying to figure out what happens next. He can no longer live here after X number of months. Oftentimes, these facilities do have a few rooms reserved for discounted rates, if you will. But you really have to prod and ask, because the first answer is often, no, we only take full pay. But as a resident already, there were some rooms available. The challenge for me was, and this sounds horrific, but I needed 6 slots to open up. So here I am thinking, I need 6 people to die before my father's money runs out so he can stay in that facility.
Talk about the mathematics of caregiving. And it's a bit like finding that seat on the dialysis bus. It was there, but they didn't have many slots and they couldn't advertise it. But if you snuck onto the bus, you might get the phone number that would get you a seat.
Great analogy. It's true.
I want to talk a bit about the COVID-19 pandemic and how it's affected caregivers, particularly as the virus has just ravaged long-term care facilities like assisted living and nursing homes. Is it, changing the conversation about where and how we care for our elders?
Absolutely. I think the most important thing to understand about caregiving during COVID is that you have an enormous amount of people walking around grieving. Whether or not they've lost a parent to COVID or lost a parent in 2020, they are grieving the ability to connect with their parents. So I think it's really important that people understand that. It is in my community, in Working Daughter, the amount of agony and grief that is being expressed right now because I can't see my parents. I can't advocate the way I normally would for my parents. My parents are declining, and I don't know what state they'll be in when we can finally truly reconnect. So I just think for any professional to understand that that's the picture right now. And so that's the layer that all of this is taking place under.
And that certainly speaks to the enormous emotional toll that caregiving can take. Is there a role here that financial advisors can play in encouraging clients to take care of themselves, whether they recommend a therapist or some sort of psychological support group?
Absolutely. I think as caregivers by nature, I think put themselves last. They're caretakers. I mean, it's right there in the definition of the term. So anything an advisor can do to encourage them to take care of themselves, again, building out that referral network is excellent because it's really all part of the package, isn't it? You need to be in your best shape emotionally and physically to set yourself up best financially and vice versa. So if you can help caregivers think about it that way, taking care of yourself is actually enabling you to take care of others, is actually setting you up for a better later in life. And ultimately, if you have children or whoever's going to be caring for you, you're investing in them as well.
And that's a very important point. Here we've been talking about the caregiver experience, but I think it was Rosalind Carter, former first lady, who said there's only 2 types of people in the world, caregivers and those who will become caregivers. How do we have this conversation now with our families in advance of what caregiving needs may be? Is there a family Zoom meeting we should be having? How do we get our parents to open up and talk about our finances? And if they're not willing to do it with some third party? And it's not just how do we want to be cared for, but how do you pay for it? Any ideas of how to get that conversation going?
I think the conversation we can be having with our families, whether it's as adults talking to our children or as adult children talking to our parents, is to see that conversation in goals and opportunity. I think part of the reason we resist talking about this stuff, right? End of life, aging, illness, you know, well, who wants to talk about it? But I think part of the resistance is it's so often framed in what's going to be taken away from you, your youth, your home, your, you know, your physical fitness, your overall health. It's framed in negative. If we can start to have these conversations earlier and frame them around opportunity, then I think we'll all be more willing to jump into the conversation. So for example, if we ask our parents, hey, mom and dad, you're not getting any younger. I mean, I think, you know, start a little light, right? I think we can all agree, you know, nobody gets younger. We only age. Or I've noticed you've been struggling a little bit with, you know, maintaining the chores or something. Have you thought about what your goals are for your next phase in life? You don't have to frame it as end of life because nobody knows when that's coming. But, you know, for your next phase of life, what's really important to you? Can we talk about that? And, you know, maybe you hear that they want to travel. Maybe you hear that they just want to be the babysitter for their grandchildren. You know, I don't know. Maybe they can't wait to shed the house and all of the chores that come with home ownership. Or maybe, you know, they're go down with the ship types. Like, I never want to leave my home. Once you understand that, then you can start to have, okay, then let's plan conversations. So say, you know, like my dad was a go down with the ship kind of guy, right? Greatest generation. They loved their, you know, they were so proud to be homeowners. They were never going out. Okay. So you want to stay in this house. What would that look like then? Do, you know, will you at some point be willing to bring in a home health aide? Will you be willing to bring in, you know, a housekeeper? Do we need to do some retrofitting in the bathroom so there are bars so that you won't fall? And so you're framing it about what they want, as opposed to what I think often happens is, you know, you can't live here forever, right? I mean, of course, people are going to shut down that way. And I think as adult talking to our children, it's the same thing. Hey, I'm sure you don't want to think about me getting older, and you probably don't want to think about being my caregiver. But let me tell you what's really important to me and what I'm starting to think about. And you bring them along into the vision and the conversation.
Liz, I think that's brilliant to frame these important conversations as opportunities of what do you want, mom and dad, or what do we want to tell our kids, rather than the inevitable conversation about losses. Well, Liz, I just want to thank you for sharing your personal journey from former family caregiver to caregiving expert. And you offer a wealth of resources on your website. Can you tell our audience some of the things they might find there and where to find them?
Sure. Everything is housed at workingdaughter.com. Makes it simple. We've got guides to what to do if your parent is in the hospital. We have guides right now around caring through COVID, checklists for senior, you know, for evaluating senior living. We even have a couple of great pieces that I think they're probably the most accessed pieces on our website about dealing with siblings. It always comes up. And we also have a program called Working Daughter at Work so that employers can offer turnkey support programs for their family caregivers.
So it all comes down to mom always liked you best, right? Liz, thanks for sharing your expertise about caregiving with the audience. And I hope female caregivers will find some hope and help through this conversation, and that their financial advisors will now know a bit more of how to support them. So for everyone here at the Retirement Repair Shop podcast, thank you for listening. This podcast, The Retirement Repair Shop, has been brought to you by Transamerica. Thank you for supporting these important conversations.
Transamerica Resources Incorporated is an Aegon company that is affiliated with various companies that include, but are not limited to, insurance companies and broker-dealers. Transamerica Resources, Inc. does not offer insurance products or securities. The information provided is for educational purposes only, should not be considered as insurance, securities, ERISA, tax, investment, legal, medical, or financial advice or guidance. Please consult your personal independent professionals for answers to your specific questions.